Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast about how to navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. This is week number 3 of our Community Questions series. In the coming weeks, we'll talk to engineering leaders around the world to answer your toughest questions. 2 weeks ago, we covered the challenges of scaling a team after a big round of funding. Last week, we learned how to build channels that bring great fit candidates. This week, we're going to talk about Moneyball. Moneyball is a term that was popularized by a book and subsequent movie about how the Oakland Athletics used data to build a baseball team filled with great players that other teams overlooked. This is one of my favorite things to talk about in software hiring. How do we find developers that other hiring managers aren't looking for? They're getting overlooked. They're hidden gems. We can moneyball them. We see a common problem shared by listeners from the largest tech hubs and smallest tech towns alike. Nobody thinks there are enough talented developers for them to hit their hiring goals. If you're in Silicon Valley, you might point out that we can't really match FANG pay. Apple and Facebook, they pay a lot. If I'm in a small city, I might say that, well, there's just not enough talent. There's not enough developers to begin with. In both cases, the fear is the same. I can't hit my hiring goals. I can't build the great team that I need. Not in this city. Well, I have good news. It is absolutely possible, and I've seen it. We've helped teams earn big hiring wins in mid-sized cities and giant tech hubs alike. The biggest difference maker isn't geography or salary. It's process. It's the hiring system. The best hiring managers are systemic about attacking the market differently. If we're going after the exact same candidates, the same profile as in the same way as FANG companies, we'll probably lose to the FANG companies. If we search for great fit engineers the larger companies overlook, then we can hit our hiring goals. There are 3 areas we've seen hiring managers have great success in finding these hidden gems. Number 1, having lots of lines in the water makes a big difference. Success comes from giving candidates many ways to find us. Lots of different job boards, meetups have lots of lines in the water. Number 2, optimizing the technical screen to find hidden gems in their current applicant pool gives us an advantage. If we're just based on credentials or we're leaning on credentials, we're probably not going to find those hidden gems. Number 3, spending effort to sell the right candidates. That's crucial because it impacts offer acceptance rates. In this competitive market, being better at selling candidates on the vision and why this is the right place for them and really meaning it and knowing what they want makes a huge difference. In this episode, we'll break down each of these categories. Now, let's hear from leaders around the country about the tactics they use to win hiring wars. First, great hiring managers look for candidates in hidden places. The first step to uncovering hidden gems is to look in unorthodox places. We don't want to spend the majority of our time on senior-level engineers with senior-level titles from major companies. If we do that, we're playing the wrong game. Instead, we want to change the rules of the game to make it more winnable. Take Moneyball as an example. Billy Beane didn't want to chase the same stars as the Yankees and the Red Sox, two of the baseball teams with the highest payroll. He knew he couldn't win that game. Instead, he optimized his team for one goal, getting on base. Getting on base is what matters in baseball. In software startups, it's about building valuable product and shipping valuable product. When we focus on that, we can make different decisions on how we recruit, how we onboard, and how we promote. If we apply those same principles to engineering, we'll probably change the way we hire. One notable change is that we could hire fewer senior engineers. We sat down with Charity Majors recently to discuss this very topic. Charity is the CTO of Honeycomb. They're an observability-focused application performance monitoring company that raised an $11.5 million Series A. Charity recently talked to us about what she calls the all-senior trap.
It's blown me away. It really has. And I feel a little bit sheepish about my in retrospect, I'm like, I doubted that this was true, and it is not. It is true.
And your ratio for kind of, let's call it junior, mid, and senior, for lack of better classification. And
we've got 2 very senior engineers out of 8.
So you're, and how many of those junior folks?
Yeah, it's like they're mostly intermediate by now, intermediate to seniorish by now. But like when they joined, they weren't. Like we had two people who were, it was their second job, both out of hack academies. One, it was his first job, you know. And I take that back. We had three senior engineers. Like they've all grown by leaps and bounds over the last couple of years, and we're kind of to the point now where we need to hire some juniors. We just don't have headcount. But like, and it took them a while to find their feet. You know, it took them a while to learn our stack. They didn't come in knowing Golang or anything, you know, so it took them, you know, 6 months or so to skill up. But like, and we have an amazing manager. Emily is just an amazing manager, mentor. She's the director now, but like she is on them, you know. She's in the code reviews and she did a good job of like helping them all level up. But like, fuck, they are an amazingly high performing team, and it has nothing. And I look at them, I'm like, if they were a team of senior people, it would not be as high performing, because every senior person is, it's boring to them to do the thing that they've done like 10 times, you know, implement another web author or whatever, you know. And you've got junior people who are like, oh yeah, this is exciting, this is fun, this is cool, right? You've got, and for the senior people, they need people to teach to, you know, they need to be able to mentor, they need to be able to flex those muscles. When you've got a team of just senior people, it's like having a meal of just desserts. You know, you actually need the full range of flavors for everyone to be on top of their game. And working on a team of people who are inspired and learning things is what inspires you and keeps you excited. You know, you don't want a team of all senior people.
And if you had to put a ratio to it, like what's the kind of ratio where stuff starts to...
You know, I think that thirds is a decent, but honestly, one or two senior people per team is great. The rest can be, especially if you have a highly technical manager like we do, who can do a lot of the coaching, then you just need a couple of people to really light the path. It also depends on the type of senior people that you have, though, because some senior archetypes are going to be, they're not happy if they aren't down deep doing the hardest problems, cranking code themselves. Now, spoiler alert, most of the problems we have in tech are not hard problems. There's a lot of things that just need to be built. Features need to get shipped.
Gotta add SSO again.
Exactly. So like, depending on the product you're building, depending on the seniors you have, some senior people are, they're so done with building all that stuff and they really just want to mentor and do architecture and like occasionally like go in and help with the thing, you know, like, so you have to know which kinds of seniors you have. And I think we have a mix, you know. We have a couple guys who are just like, they want to go deep in the code, you know, and maybe do some architecture. And then we have, you know, one that's just kind of done with that, you know, and functions more as a manager who occasionally builds things. And that's great. You know, it's very individual at our stage. Whereas, you know, at Pinterest levels and above, you know, they're much more, they're much more recipes where they're like, okay, we're going to assemble a team using these building blocks, which is why, this is why I love startups, right? Because I love the unique and individual baskets.
I hear the most common objection. I think most people intellectually believe that, but then they look at their roadmap, or not most, but a lot of people look at that. Okay, I got this deadline 4 months out. I've got one headcount. And the term I hear is hit the ground running.
If you have one spot, then yes, you should start with a senior engineer. But one headcount is different from one spot, right? It's one headcount to me says that you have a team already. And you have one that you can hire. And the temptation is always going to be to hire the most senior person you can get to take that salary, which is why you need to lean against those impulses. You need to look at who you've got. And you need to build a team with the team in mind, right? You need to not just take each headcount one at a time. You need to have a plan. You know, like, and as a founder, I'm super sympathetic to this, because sometimes when you're building, your horizon, your lifetime is 6 months long. That's as long as you've got to, you run out of money. And whatever you do in that time to get you yourself over that hurdle is, you'll do what you have to do, right? And I've had to make some very, very hard calls like that. But most of the time, like, the goal is to not be operating in that mindset. The goal is to have a horizon of a year or two. And if you're building for a year or two, you assemble a very different team.
There are some cases when we genuinely need a lot more senior engineers. We explored one of those cases on our episode on changes after a big round of funding. Those are usually edge cases, though. We're likely skewed if our ratio is higher than one senior engineer for every one junior engineer. Charity isn't alone in her opinion. We conducted the survey of senior software engineers, which validated the belief. 78.5% of respondents said that having too many senior engineers on the team would make them more likely to seek a new role. That's most senior engineers are more likely to seek a new role if there are too many seniors. That's because senior engineers value mentoring. They also don't like doing plumbing work. This realization dramatically changes the calculus for both how we set hiring goals and how quickly we can hit them. It takes approximately 30% longer to hire a mid-level engineer compared to a junior engineer. Additionally, it takes about twice as long to hire a senior engineer as it does to hire a mid-level engineer. This means if we need junior engineers to get the job done and we're hiring seniors, we're not only overpaying for that work, we're taking a long time. We're talking 3 or 4 times as long to get the hiring done. Even worse, if we're overweight in seniors, we can increase our team's churn. Talented senior engineers often seek out roles where juniors can handle kind of the grunt work, or at least what's grunt work to seniors. Seniority mix isn't the only place where we can see inefficiencies. When sourcing junior candidates, too many people skew their candidate pool by credentials. The most common example is undervaluing coding bootcamp grads and career switchers. John Harden is a principal software engineer at Karanu who recently raised a $25 million Series A. He talked to us about what it takes to hire from coding bootcamps.
You know, you got to keep in mind, if you're hiring from one of these bootcamps, you're not hiring by any means a seasoned engineer. You're not hiring somebody that's gone through a traditional 4-year of schooling and may have done a few years of programming. You might be hiring somebody that's as short as 16 weeks. We hired a veterinarian technician that was here for, she was a vet tech for 2 years, decided it was time for her to career to change. Then she switched into being a software engineer and she joined us 3 months later. What I learned from that experience is that you got to have kind of a process in play to make sure that these people are successful and that these academy graduates are successful. And it's not a copy paste from any college hire pipeline that you might have or any college hire onboarding strategy that you have. It's a different one. It's a lot more focused on pair programming is absolutely critical, I think, when you're bringing in those junior engineers, because as a senior engineer, if you're listening, or if you're just an engineer by trade for a while, what you understand is that learning a code base it's a vast challenge. You've got just understanding the principles that they're doing, understand the methodologies that they're doing, and then finding those skeletons in the closet and making sure you get what's going on there. But with a junior engineer, they don't know really where to even begin. This is their first time ever coming into a code base, coming into a actual product or project. So starting them off with something small, but pushing them into a lot of different areas of the product. I know that sounds odd, but maybe a task that's...
Lay us out like the kind of, what is the first couple weeks? You hire a new bootcamp grad, you're excited, you know that pair programming is important. How does that operationalize? What does that look like for their schedule?
The first week is always about learning the product. I think that they've got to be able to understand the product that they're working in and their features and functionality. I think that there's a lot of one-on-one training. We assign them always what we call an ambassador, which is a person that they can ask anything. So it doesn't matter what it is. It's, what's our HR policy? Because some of these people might actually be the first job they've ever had. So what are HR policies? Yeah.
Yeah. So is this typically an engineer, someone on their team, or does it really matter?
Yeah, we try to grab a senior engineer. You always want to make sure that you've at least got a 1-to-2 or a, at least 1-to-1 ratio of senior talent with junior talent. You asked earlier what was some of the mistakes we made. At one point, we had pulled in, we were having such wild success with the juniors. We're like, well, what can it hurt to bring in another? And that's when we were 2-to-2 and we brought in 2-to-3 and we started to realize that 1-to-1 training kind of fell apart. So the ambassador's big. Making sure that you have a lot of time booked out. This is one of those things that it's going to cost a lot up front to gain the value in the back end. It's not one of those things that you're not going to be able to hire an academy graduate and be able to flip them around and have them, adding to the sprint within even maybe the first month. I mean, they're adding value, but it's the value you're getting out of it is nowhere near the amount of time you're investing into it initially.
John's team isn't competing with large companies for senior talent. He isn't reliant on finding senior engineers in a tight local market. Instead, he broadened his hiring pool and is winning at a different game. But John's story isn't universal. Sometimes we really do need senior level engineers with specific skills. In that case, some hiring managers can paint themselves into a corner. Top hiring managers know that there are always other options. Instead of throwing up our hands and saying there aren't enough candidates, we look to remote hiring. Listen to what Andreas Klinger, the head of remote at AngelList, had to say about us building a remote team.
I get the arrogance of expecting to be having a lot of engineers if you're like in San Francisco. I get that, right? Or like in Silicon Valley. Sure, why not? But if you're like in a small town or like in a, even if it's like a major city in America that has like less than a million people, why do you expect the best people of the world to live there? Like statistically speaking, the majority of the world is not in the city where you live, period, you know, by a fact of billions. So period, it's you're fishing in a small pond. And if the small pond has like another other interesting startups to work on, like, holy shit. Like it gets to the point, like I regularly invest or advise people to invest. And I talk to startups like you are launching in San Francisco and you're trying to build up your engineering team here. And I don't see this to be like the hip shit every engineer wants to work on because it's like their fucking career boost. You know, like if you work on a really technically complex product, it has a good career boost. Like you can go to Google and afterwards everywhere, right? So how do you expect actually to hire people? And more importantly, how do you expect them to retain them? Because if you have to rehire every 1.5 years, your whole hiring process is like fucked, you know? Like you can't build up anything in the team. And that's the default in San Francisco, you know? That's the default if you're good, you know? That's not the default if you're like breakout, like you're just starting and nobody knows about you and your product is like not really interesting. It's just like whatever, right? What the fuck are you doing?
There's a lot of interest in, there's a lot of interesting things where you can make an impact in San Francisco.
Exactly. And the truth, honestly, this is true for almost every city, right? So remote, you just have a bigger pond to fish in, as Matt Mullenweg says. That being said, it's not necessarily easier just because you have more candidates. You can be a little bit more pickier, which is very often fine, you know, but it's still a very highly involved process. Like most remote teams that I know have people hired full-time just for hiring, you know, because it's a very involved process. If you have, and for example, at Product Hunt, we used to have several hundred applicants for each job after 1 or 2 days. And we were like, okay, I'm cutting this job after 4 days because I know it's freaking unfair because like you might not have heard about it. You might not, like you're considering it, you're preparing your shit and now it's like the job is gone. What the fuck, you know? But I can't deal with more than 400 or 500 applicants in this now, like, and I will reopen it maybe, you know, I don't know, but holy shit. And this was a regular scenario for us. And I know companies you most likely don't even know that are bootstrapped, 30 people, another one that's like 40, 50 people. They get 1,000 applicants per month for like 2 to 3 jobs. You know, if a larger, well-known remote company like Doist opens up a role in a non-engineering role like customer care, right? They get realistically more than 1,000 applicants. Not all of them good. Not all of them perfect, not all of them matching, you know, but it's at least a start.
There are almost always enough candidates for us to hit our goals if we know where to look. Top hiring managers know that and they take advantage. But sourcing more candidates isn't always enough. Some hiring managers fall into the trap of feeling like there are more than enough applicants, but not enough qualified candidates. Top hiring managers do things a little differently when screening applicants. The best hiring managers find hidden gems in their applicant pool. We often hear hiring managers say that they have too many applications, but still struggle to find qualified applicants. This sounds counterintuitive, but it makes sense when you consider the traditional screening process. The first filter that many companies use is to screen candidates on their resume. As a result, candidates with quote-unquote good resumes, including those with a computer science degree or previous software company experience, they get many interviews. Meanwhile, some great engineers may not have the resume that makes it past the many first filters. I know amazing DevOps engineers who were long-haul truckers, people with odd backgrounds that led to their success. But those folks do not do well on a resume screen. If we're not careful, we end up in the same predicament as before. If we're competing for a small number of candidates with every other hiring manager in town because of their resume. The best hiring managers think a little bit differently about how they screen. Instead of screening based on weaknesses, they hire for strengths. We sat down with Charity Majors, CTO of Honeycomb, to learn how she uses these principles to make smart hires.
The number one thing that I would say is, remember that you're hiring for strengths, not for lack of weakness, right? You're hiring a person for their very particular strengths, and you should invest in their career and helping them build on those strengths. And their weaknesses just need to be brought up to an acceptable level of functioning, right? This is something that I learned at Facebook. My tenure at Facebook wasn't amazing, but I learned some great lessons there. And one of the things was this, know what you're hiring for. You're not hiring a generic engineer, right? Presumably, you need them to do a particular job. And you would rather have someone who's passionate about those things that you need than not terrible at anything, right? And when you're investing in people, invest in their strengths, not their weaknesses. And when you're interviewing people, make sure that you're drawing out those strengths. Like, we always try to ask people, how can I see you at your best? What is your strength? Have I seen you at your best? What can I do? Like, yes, obviously you have your process, and you should be measuring people on the same question to have consistency, and all these things are good. But also, if in our process, we haven't drawn out something where you feel like you're shown at your best, what can we do? Right. And that gives them back some agency too, and some ownership, and some, like, the power differentials are so extreme in a hiring situation that I think you should do everything you can to create a level playing field and to make it clear that you're interviewing us just as much as we're interviewing you. And we also have a responsibility to see you at your best. Whether or not we end up hiring you, these should be the goals, right? Because, like, if there's one thing that as a manager, as a founder, I used to always hear as a bullshit phrase, it was not a good fit. I always just thought not a good fit right now was just this bullshit HR phrase that you said to cover up, and sometimes it is. I'm not making apologies for that. But more often it has been like, I respect you. I hope you respect us. We have a very limited budget and this is not the best fit right now, but I would love to work with you at some point in the future. But like, it's just not. This is what we need. This narrow, tiny thing right here is what we need. And that's, I think that it's not the greatest fit right now. And I have to be kind of ruthless about that.
I think that's reasonable. My take on that is, if you can say not a fit, you have to be able to describe what a fit looks like.
Yes, that is a great point. And be honest about it. Like, most people would rather have honest, kind feedback about why it's not a good fit or where they could improve than just be given some boilerplate bullshit.
One thing we fiddle with is, instead of giving feedback that is negative, like what someone did wrong, we've found better results with just saying, this is exactly what we were looking for. Like, you could have known this, but this is what the best candidate said.
You couldn't know this. Yeah. I also really like to give people, to eliminate that guessing game about what people are, what we're looking for. A lot of people's terror and the fear and the, none of us do our best work when we're in a state of fear, right? Anything we can do to make people feel comfortable and, on a level playing field with us is good. But a lot of what creates that fear is uncertainty and not knowing. So we try and tell people exactly what we're looking for up front so that they don't have to guess. you can't always do a perfect job of that, but any attempt that you can make is good. And also just letting them know that questions are welcome. And if it's not clear, please ask, because we're not trying. This isn't a game. We're not toying with you. We're trying to get something specific out, because that's the scenario that they're going to be in. Hopefully, if they're your coworker, you're not going to be playing games with them or trying to make them guess. You're going to be being like, here is specifically what I'm looking for. Can you help me?
At my startup, Woven, we work with hiring managers across the country, and we see the same results. For the folks that are fishing in the exact same pond as the rest of the market, they get similar results. For the folks that want outsized results, they need to take risks and make evidence-based decisions. Randy Searing is the chief executive developer at Level 12, a custom software development shop. He's done a lot of work over the course of the last 20 years to learn the hard work of hiring.
You guys wouldn't have existed, probably, maybe. I don't know when exactly your start date was. But if I could go back, I would have never hired a developer without what you guys have done for us. Like, that one piece of information, and I'm not sure it's, I'm not sure it's perfect. Again, we're still even iterating on.
It is not perfect. I can see that.
Yeah, but having that one piece of information with a relatively little engagement of our time and a relatively little engagement on the candidate's time would have saved us. Like, and honestly, so this actually, I think, dovetails well into your question. So, you know, what would I have told my younger self? I'm thinking like way younger, but really even like, you know, 18 months younger, I hired a candidate at the end of 2017 now who started working for us in 2018. And all the skills tests I did said, you know, probably average gifting, but mature developer. And so we wanted to give him a chance, thought it would probably work out pretty well. We had some concerns, but for the most part, we're optimistic. And he bombed really hard. And that was actually, it was that interaction that made me ask, what did I miss? I've got 16 hours of skills tests. I brought that guy on for an on-site interview. I had some concerns, but I had no really big red flags. And he did really poorly at level 12. And I think we gave him 5 months, like we gave him a decent amount of time and coaching to try to turn things around. He just was not able to do it. And so we started asking some really hard questions about why was he not successful at level 12? What about our environment allowed him to be successful at his previous job, but not ours? And what we came away with had to do with communication of technical topics, and in particular, that ability of a developer to break down business requirements in their mind quickly and understand how that's going to impact the code in the job, so they can give immediate feedback during a conversation and, you know, have that dialogue, whether it's with their team lead or an architectural meeting that we're having or with a customer, that ability to really quickly kind of walk up and down that stack in terms of the top of the stack would be the very high level business requirements. What is the business trying to do? Why? What value does that give them? What kind of risks are involved? What kind of challenges are the people going to have using the software? And then the very low part of the stack would be, well, what actual code is going to be written? What data structures are we going to use? And so a developer's ability to walk really quickly up and down that stack is what we realized that particular employee did not have, and what we realized was really essential to how we do development at level 12. Because our hierarchy is very shallow. We basically have the customer, a team lead, and then the developer. And we want to minimize how much work the team lead has to do in terms of really breaking down a project for a dev. We need a dev to be part of that conversation, asking questions, pushing back if necessary, building that mental model of what they're going to have to build, and then go put that in an issue and then go work on the project. And we just found that candidate did not have, or that employee did not have, that ability. And so that actually became the kind of the key thing that we started working with you guys in terms of how do we test for this, because it seems to be the one thing that you could potentially get through the rest of our process with, and we wouldn't necessarily know it.
There are three levers we've seen make a huge impact for our clients as they've hired hidden gems on their teams. Number one, lead with an information-dense assessment. Number two, include as many people as possible in the assessment process. That broad base helps make the assessment better and also helps the interviewing committee, the hiring committee, understand what good looks like on an assessment. Even better, it allows the hiring committee to ask follow-up questions about the assessment, which creates really productive, really concrete engineering conversations. Number three, they use the results as a weight for the decision instead of a filter. So if someone doesn't do great on an assessment, but they have other strengths, we have the opportunity to hire them for the strengths versus dropping them for maybe what's a mediocre, maybe not even a weakness, just a lack of strength. There's one last secret that top hiring managers use to outperform their peers. The fewer offers get rejected, the fewer candidates we need for the role. Increase our offer acceptance rate so we need fewer candidates. It can be demoralizing to go through several interviews with a candidate, get to know them, and then have them reject our final offer. This is especially true when we are working to hit aggressive hiring goals. Unfortunately, it's common. It's increasingly common, especially with the rise of talent marketplaces where many companies are competing for the same talented candidate. On average, startups in Silicon Valley can hope to expect a 1/3 rejection rate. 2/3 acceptance is actually good right now. There are some simple things we can do to reduce the likelihood that our offer is rejected, though. Number one, we can move fast. Latency and follow-up increases the probability that a candidate will reject our offer. It means we're going to have more competition and less time for them, more time for them to forget why they love us. Best-in-class hiring managers can go from resume screen to offer in 2 weeks. Number two, provide feedback. Great engineers want to work for great coaches. They're intrinsically motivated to get better. We've talked to engineering candidates who've taken offers for less money because the company provided better feedback. Number three, we have to ask. A great question in the interview process at the end is to ask the candidate, what would prevent you from accepting our offer? Sometimes the things are really simple. We had an intern that when I asked this question, she was like, well, I don't know if I can get to the office. And that was the easiest objection to overcome. We will pay for that. That's easy. And if I hadn't asked, I wouldn't have known. Maybe she accepts another offer. This question, by seeking the no, allows us to handle objections before the offer is extended and make things right. We could also benefit by doing regular audits of our hiring process through the lens of selling the candidate experience. Austin Broyles is the director of engineering at a Bay Area software company called Primer. They raised $40 million in the Series B in November. He was able to double his offer acceptance rate using a sandwich.
So it's definitely something we struggled with over the past year. Our acceptance rate was somewhere in the 30s, which I knew was not good, which is surprising because I think Primer has such a compelling opportunity. We build machines that read and write, and our mission is to accelerate human understanding of the world. And I think like AI over the next decade is probably one of the most important skill sets to develop and domains to explore, and then will likely be the most impactful area to contribute to. So I was looking at all of that and saying, like, am I just doing a terrible job selling this? What's going on? And so we tried like a number of different things, iterated on how I was pitching the company, but really got feedback from the team that like, hey, our on-site experience is actually kind of brutal. We were putting somebody in a room, giving them a sandwich, and then interviewing and grilling them for an hour. And so many of the candidates wouldn't actually be able to even eat the sandwich. The ones that did, you know, it just didn't feel like a comfortable experience. And so we really weren't presenting the company in a great light there. They weren't getting to know the company through that experience. Meanwhile, because of the low close rate, I was really concerned about the amount of time that my teams were investing in this process. And because of the low close rate, I felt that I had to get a lot of candidates through the system so that at least we'll get the hires that we needed. And it turns out that was kind of wrong on all fronts. So after experimenting with different things, the one thing that really helped there was rather than trying to compress the onsite down, take up less time from people on the team, actually add a separate lunch slot where three members of the team could take the candidate offsite, get to know them a little bit in an informal setting, not feel like they're being grilled, but let them kind of get to know the rest of the company. And so those people come from across the company in different roles, but bring a lot of perspective, and the personality of the company is really able to shine. We were able to nearly double the close rates with just that one change. And so as a result, the engineers involved have to spend a lot less time interviewing because we're able to close the engineers that we want to close.
Are you in the middle of a big hiring blitz? If so, I want to hear from you. What hacks have you learned to find engineers that other managers overlooked? Send me an email at wes@woventeams.com. I read every email and I love hearing from listeners. That's wes@woventeams.com. Next week, we'll discuss how to design a faster hiring process without sacrificing results. Until then, keep on scaling.